The Guardian.
I'm Alok Char. You're listening to Science Weekly. We're in the Atacama Desert in Chile, visiting some astonishing telescopes at the top of the world. They will see bits of the universe that have, until now, been hidden from view. And they'll give scientists a completely new insight into the origin of stars, planets, black holes, and the universe itself. At the Mount Paranal Observatory in northern Chile, none of the scientists are allowed to stay longer than 14 days at a time. Set in the desert, hundreds of miles from the nearest town, this is a hostile place for people, but an ideal place to look at distant parts of the universe. The bone-dry air allows the VLT, or Very Large Telescope, to track and measure cosmic objects such as stars, planets, and black holes with incredible precision. The VLT is composed of four separate 8-meter-wide mirrors, each one made from a single piece of polished glass. Underneath these mirrors are pistons and actuators that change the shape of the glass 100 times a second. This counteracts the distorting effects of the air on the light that comes in from distant stars. This telescope, operated by the European Southern Observatory, ESO, gave us the first direct image of an exoplanet, and it allowed individual stars to be tracked around the black hole in the middle of the Milky Way. But it isn't the most extreme telescope in ESO's arsenal. Near the Chilean border with Bolivia, 5 kilometres high in the Andes, there's an even bigger, more sensitive telescope, the Atacama Large Millimeter Array, or ALMA. ALMA detects cosmic radiation similar to microwaves, which is around 1,000 times longer than the light we see with our eyes. These waves are easily absorbed by water in the atmosphere, which is why the ultra-dry Shahnantor Plateau was chosen to build this new telescope.
So we're 5,000 metres up on the Shahnantor Plateau in the Andes. I'm standing at the site of the Atacama Large Millimeter Array. There are 20 dishes in operation at the moment. There will be 66 eventually. And they're sort of doing a ballet as they all synchronise and move to different parts of the sky. They're tracking different dust clouds and galaxies. The air up here is absolutely frigid and it's very thin. 5,000 metres is halfway up to where a jumbo jet might be flying. So there's half the amount of oxygen as there is at sea level. And so we've been told to walk very, very slowly. We've been told not to run. If your hat flies off, you're not meant to run after it. We've even given us little oxygen canisters in case we feel a bit lightheaded. So far, I seem to be okay, but that's probably tempting fate and I'll fall over in a second. But this is quite incredible. In between so many mountains, these huge 20-meter dishes, they're almost ghostly in the way they're just moving around at the sky. It'll take a couple more years to actually put the rest of the dishes up, one by one. I'm just going to walk up to one of the carbon fibre telescopes. Here we go. Wow, I'm so close, I could almost touch one of these things, but I don't think I should. I'm not allowed to touch this, right? No, he's saying no. The colours here are amazing. The desert is bright orange, looks like Mars, and then the sky is this amazing deep blue, quickly getting up to black. And the mountains in the distance, they're black, tipped with snow and salt, actually.
My name is Jean Turner, and I'm a professor at UCLA, and my research is on millimeter and submillimeter observations of galaxies. ALMA is going to be very sensitive to dusty galaxies in the early universe, just because of the way their spectrum is and where they are located. It's going to be very sensitive, so I think you're going to see a lot of results coming out on galaxies that are distant and dusty.
So new galaxies, baby galaxies, that kind of thing.
Yes, very early galaxies, early in the universe, and they're probably very different from the ones we see close to the Milky Way.
Now, I was just wondering what it feels like for an astronomer like you to see this massive thing being built. It's being built for the last few years. It's probably been in planning stages for decades before that. And it's not a simple exercise. I mean, there are going to be 66 carbon fiber dishes over there. There are 20 right now. I mean, how does it feel to sort of see it and actually come to life?
I've been sitting on committees for 25 years, and I just never thought I'd see the day. It's been a huge effort over decades of many, many scientists to bring this about. But it's a new wavelength band that's opening up, and I think it's going to be revolutionary.
And one final thing, we're at 5,000 meters. Apparently, there's half the oxygen here as there is at sea level. How are you feeling?
I'm feeling just fine, but I have spent a lot of time on mountaintops, and I know what to do and what not to do.
We were talking earlier about noises in labs. Now, I've been trying to collect as many noises in different labs as possible. All you hear are fans and compressors. Is that as exciting as it gets in astronomy labs?
Well, there is something about a closed cycle refrigerator, the compressor going. It's like a clock ticking. It's very, very soothing to a radio astronomer because it means things are working. They have to be very, very cold. And so you have just a super duper refrigerator to keep them, 4 degrees above zero, absolute zero. So.
Stars are usually formed in very dense clouds of dust, from which only half of the light that emerges can be detected by optical and infrared telescopes. That's where ALMA can help. These dust clouds might hide the stars that are forming within them, but they're also heated up by the starlight. This dust absorbs the radiation and re-emits it at the microwave frequency, which ALMA can detect. This telescope's increased sensitivity over current instruments means that it's expected to find a previously unseen galaxy every 3 minutes. By 2013, ALMA will have 66 carbon fibre antennas, which can be arranged in countless configurations, up to 10 miles apart across the mountains. The submillimeter light from distant stars, galaxies and dust clouds makes its way across the universe. When it reaches the ALMA dishes, the light goes through a carefully engineered obstacle course to ensure it's measured with maximum precision. Here's Dr. Richard Hills, project scientist at ALMA.
Okay, so this is now the heart of ALMA, where the coordination takes place. You can just see nice racks of electronics. But just to give you some idea of what's in here, I've described how these waves arrive from space, and we have to make sure that we actually get the relative times of arrival of the signals at the different antennas to exquisite precision. So the way we do that is actually by having a reference here, which is generated in these racks. The blue boxes over there contain lasers, and the light coming out of those lasers has these time markers on it, and it's sent out on optical fibers. The little yellow fibers coming out the top of these cabinets go out to the antennas. And so when the time signals arrive at the antennas, those are essentially used to synchronize everything and to put marks on the signals. So the signals that now come back, we put little markers on saying this one came in at this time, and it's the time with so many hours, minutes and seconds down to, in fact, picoseconds of time. So 10 to the minus 13, 10 to the minus 14 of a second of time. Okay, and in order to get that precision, we have to allow for the fact that, for example, the fibers are continuously changing their length, so the time for the light to propagate is changing, just due to temperature and the fact that the telescopes move. So some of the light is turned around and sent back again, and they measure the round trip time in these units here. And these things here called line length corrector, LLC, has another coil of fiber in it with a pair of little pistons on it, and it stretches the fiber in here to compensate for the changes of the fiber that's going out to the antenna. So it actually keeps the fiber in exactly the same length. It actually makes sure that you get the same number of wavelengths of light all the way out and back again, making it so that the individual antennae, the individual dishes, are all part of the same telescope.
This technique of combining signals from several receivers, known as interferometry, means that astronomers effectively get the benefits of a much larger telescope without actually having to build it. Combining data from all 66 12-meter-wide ALMA antennae means that it will achieve the sensitivity of a telescope that has a single dish 14,000 meters wide.
It's hard to believe we're 5,000 meters up. It looks like an old computer lab.
I mean, obviously we don't. What's happening in here is that we've got all these antenna stations. We will have them spread out across the plateau. Now, of course, we have to make sure that the signals that we're making in this time system are actually being sent to the right place. So when we move an antenna to a certain place, we have to connect the fibers so they go to that antenna. So that's what these switch panels are here. And then similarly, when the signals come back, now I haven't talked about what's coming back, but inside the telescope, we have these receivers, big cans cooled down to very low temperature with the receivers inside. That picks up the very weak signals and amplifies them to a level that we can actually do something useful. And then the next thing we do is digitize them. And again, we put them onto, we have lasers, we modulate the lasers, and we send them back as digital signals. Okay? So they come back on these fibers over here, again from all the antennas, and the data rate from each antenna is 120 gigabits per second. Okay? That's the, you know, you talk about broadband being so many megabits. Here we've got gigabits, and in fact 120 gigabits per second per antenna.
The incoming light waves are first sent into an instrument known as the correlator. Here, thousands of microprocessors mark each incoming light wave with a timestamp, accurate down to picoseconds, to ensure that all the light from a single source can be reunited later in the detectors. The correlator passes its perfectly timed light down the corridor to a second refrigerated room that compares signals from each antenna at each specific point in time. It looks for signals that appear to come from the same source in the sky, picking out the light from galaxies or dust clouds from the background hum of the universe.
Okay, so this is the famous correlator, and the reason it's called that is that another way of thinking about this whole process of combining the signals is that what arrives at each telescope, there are these very, very faint signals, but also coming into each telescope is the emission from the microwave background, the emission from the atmosphere, the noise that's generated in the telescope itself and in the receivers. And so those are all maybe 100 or 1,000, or maybe in the case of a really faint object, a million times stronger than what we're actually looking for. But they will be random noise, whereas the signals that have come from our distant galaxy will be the same. It'll be the same signal buried down in that noise. So we have to look for in the signals that come in, we have to look for the correlation, the bits of that signal that are the same, correlating. Okay? So that's why this machine is called a correlator. But again, it's working digitally. We've already got the signals in the form of numbers. Just as in your phone, your mobile phone, when you speak into it, it takes your voice and makes it into a string of numbers, and then it's those numbers that it sends to the base station and so on. And it's the same thing here. We've got a string of numbers coming back that represent the signal and the noise. And we've got to combine those. The data rate from each telescope is very fast, 120 gigabits per second. And we actually want to look at, compare each bit with all the bits from all the other telescopes. So we've got, eventually, for this device is actually designed to take up to 64 telescopes. In the other room, there's another system that can do the smaller telescopes and combine those. Because the signals from different places in the sky arrive with slightly different times, that's what actually enables you to tell where in the image each individual object is. It's the different times, just from the fact that the signals on one side of the image will get to the telescopes on one side of the array quicker than the others. So not only do we have to compare each sample, we've got to compare the ones at slightly different times as well. So the net result is that the amount of arithmetic you need to do in this comes up to more than 10 to the 16 operations per second. Now, a fast PC does, we talk about a 2 gigahertz clock rate in your PC, so that's doing 2 times 10 to the 9 And we're up at 10 to the 16, 2 × 10⁻⁶ operations per second.
In October last year, ALMA released its first scientific image, taking my measurements from 16 of the dishes then installed on the Shaknantor site. It showed the violent swirls of the antennae galaxies, a pair of distorted spiral galaxies that are in the process of colliding about 70 million light years from Earth.
One of the things, of course, we can see is the so-called cosmic microwave background, which the universe started as this intensely hot fireball. It expanded enormously,
yeah.
And so that and as it expands, it cools, and the temperature that it's now got down to is equivalent to, in fact, it's 2.7 degrees above absolute zero.
Okay.
And that means it gives off actually only the longer millimeter wavelengths. The peak of the signal comes out at about 2 millimeters wavelength. When you use dishes joined together like this, those signals essentially get washed out. It just acts as a background. Okay. On the other hand, if there's a place where a cluster of galaxies is being formed, then that will actually have the effect of scattering some of that microwave background radiation, and it removes it from the millimeter wave band, and you actually see a shadow against the background. And that's an effect that we will be studying with ALMA. We'll be able to see these distant clusters of galaxies that have been formed much later than the Big Bang itself, but still a very long time ago in terms of the history of the universe, and to see the way the gas is, and actually you can also see the presence of the dark matter in those clusters of galaxies. But when we use this aperture synthesis technique, this combining of the dishes, each dish combines the signal with each of the other dishes. So each time you bring up an additional dish, when you go from 16 to 17, you get an extra 16 lots of information. So the amount of detail, the complexity of the image that you can make actually goes effectively to the square of the number of dishes. So when we've got 4 times as many dishes, we'll have 16 times as much information in the pictures.
Yeah.
Okay? And in addition, of course, the sensitivity increases. We can detect weaker signals. But the other thing, that the most important thing, will be just the ability to move the dishes out to the long baselines and get this high angular resolution to see the fine detail. And as I said, that will be a factor of 100 in each dimension. And so if we move them 100 times further apart, we get 100 times more in each element. So for a given object, you actually get 10,000 times more pixels in your image. So it's like increasing 10 kilopixel camera to a megapixel camera.
Mm, yep.
That's the biggest increase.
ALMA won't be complete until 2013, but ESO already has plans to build the next generation of telescope. The European Extremely Large Telescope, ELT, will be situated a few dozen kilometres from the main VLT observatory site at Paranal. The ink on the contracts for this next-generation telescope is barely dry. The agreements from the Chilean government to bequeath the site at the top of Mount Armazones was only granted in late 2011. There's not even a road to the site yet. Getting to the summit of the 3,000-metre-high peak from the nearest highway entails a bone-shaking ride that kicks up thick clouds of dust from the desert. The ELT will have a much greater collecting power than the telescopes on Paranal, thanks to a primary mirror of almost 40 metres wide. Building this 1 billion euro telescope will take at least a decade and require completely new technology. No one knows how to build a 40 metre mirror from a single block of glass, never mind transport it safely through the desert, so it'll be composed of around 1,000 smaller hexagonal segments. The main mirror will reflect the ancient starlight it detects onto a 4-meter-wide secondary mirror before it goes on to hit the detectors. Collecting more light will enable it to resolve more detail than anything before it. ELT will be able to take pictures of exoplanets directly and even work out what chemical elements are present in their atmospheres. It'll see further into deep space and therefore further back towards the beginning of the universe. It'll explore questions around the nature of dark energy and dark matter. Here's ESO's Gonzalo Agando.
So finally, we're here at the summit of Cerro Armazones,
after this wild drive from Cerro Paranal, we are at an altitude of around 3,000 meters, and we are basically in the middle of nowhere in the heart of the Atacama Desert. This is the site chosen to build the planned EELT, the Extremely Large Telescope.
So after VLT, after ALMA, the next plan is this Extremely Large Telescope. Tell us what that will do that the former two telescopes have not been able to do so far.
The EELT will be the largest optical infrared telescope in the world by far. You saw at Paranal these huge machines, but every single telescope has a one mirror of 8.2 meters in diameter. The EELT will have a collecting power, a much higher collecting power, thanks to the primary mirror of around 40 meters. So it will be by far the largest optical telescope in the world, so it will be able to collect much more light than other telescopes, and also the capacity to resolve details, the resolution power will also be much higher. So some things that we expect to do that currently we are not able to do in the hot topic of searching and study of exoplanets in the context of life in the universe, we will be able not only to detect indirectly exoplanets, but to do direct imaging of the planets, and not only that, but even characterization of those planets to study the atmosphere of those planets.
So will you be able to actually see the colors of the planets, maybe even whether they're blue or green and have water and other sorts of things?
Yeah, exactly. We will be able to have clues about the atmosphere, which is connected, of course, to the search of life, and if there are some conditions to host life as we know it. Also, the ELT will be able to look and to study the first galaxies that were born. Also, it will explore the big questions on the nature of the dark energy, dark matter. It will study the complete variety of subjects in astronomy, from the very closest ones studying the solar system to the limits of the universe. And more importantly, I would say, is the unexpected or the surprises, that the things that astronomers are not able to even guess today, and all the surprises and big surprises that we may be able to find, and they can reshape the astronomy as we know it.
Now, can you give us a cost and a time scale? I mean, how much does a 42-meter sophisticated telescope in the middle of nowhere cost?
The total cost for the construction of the ELT is estimated in around 1 billion euros. The decision process is going well, and we expect that by the end of this year, a decision will be taken to start construction next year.
And just one final thing, I mean, the science being done by ESO is obviously incredibly impressive and cutting edge. Why can't you think up better names for the telescopes? Very large telescope, extremely large telescope. Is there a plan to maybe rename it something else one day?
Yeah, I mean, we may consider to run a competition and ask the public for better ideas than this name that we have come up so far.
It's not a priority yet.
Right now, we're mostly focused on the projects themselves, but good idea to help to share basically the excitement of these projects, the challenges with the general public.
Do you mind if we were to ask our listeners to send in suggestions for names for the ELT?
Yeah, we would be very happy to hear suggestions.
My name is Michael Sterzig. I'm astronomer at the European Southern Observatory. I'm physicist, and I've been working here in Chile since 13 years. And what I'm doing nowadays is I'm deputy director of the VLT Observatory, what we call La Silla Paranal Observatory.
So tell us what the European Southern Observatory is.
What we do in Chile is we run and we operate the installations, the facilities, the astronomical facilities that are installed here on behalf of the European partners that are members of the European Southern Observatory member states.
Why is Chile such a great place for all of this radio astronomy and optical astronomy?
I guess there are two reasons for that. One is that Chile is located in the southern hemisphere, so classically in the last century the sky was explored in the northern hemisphere, but many of the most interesting objects are actually only observable from the southern hemisphere, and these are the center of the galaxy and our neighboring galaxies like the Magellanic Clouds. And the other obvious reason why Chile is the weather. So in the sites that we where we operate our facilities, we have more than 300 clear nights per year. And again, with the site selection for the exercise of the best site selection for the ELT, it could be demonstrated that Chile is really the best place where to locate telescopes in the world.
Now, the Paranal site is famous for the VLT, the Very Large Telescope. There's 4 8-meter-wide optical telescopes there. They've found some amazing things in their more than decade of sort of observing the skies. Can you give us a rundown of what you think are the few greatest hits?
Well, a few of the greatest hits, it's a very subjective selection, as you can imagine from an astronomer. So there's one area which is the area of exoplanets. Actually, where we are world leaders is the discovery of new exoplanets with the radial velocity method, and that is done with a world-class instrument called HARPS in La Silla. So in Paranal now, what happened is that what we can do is we can start actually image these planets, not just these radial velocity planets, but we are sensitive and we are in a spatial and sensitivity regime where we can start to see companions around bright stars and companions that are fainter and fainter, less and less massive, and where we approach in the planetary regime. And these are interesting discoveries made at the VLT. In another regimes, an interesting discovery with the VLT is actually the center of our Milky Way, is the black hole that we do now know in a much more consolidated way with VLT observations, and the immediate vicinity of the black hole, of the central engine of our Milky Way, actually the physical processes that are happening there, like flaring and like very energetic phenomena that are triggered by these central black holes that we characterize with the VLT, and that allow to probe some very fundamental physics like general relativity.
What would your dream discovery be?
Well, I mean, I do like planets, I do like exoplanets, and if we really would characterize a planet in a habitable zone, I think that would be a major hit for actually mankind.
Do you think it'll happen within the next couple of decades?
Actually, I'm pretty convinced that it will happen with the ELT.
One final question. The budgets for these things are decided decades in advance. The ELT is something like €1 billion. The ALMA project is something similar. Do economic fluctuations affect you? I mean, right now, every government in the world is cutting their science funding or, you know, trying to rein back. Does it affect what you do?
I guess it does affect and feedback. I mean, the macroeconomic situation on astronomers, and astronomers have always to ask themselves and to justify, of course, I mean, is the money well spent? Because the immediate return to industry is significant because our invests bids and industry contributions. However, what is true is that, I mean, we are not gaining any profit with our being, so it's a cultural endeavor that we are doing, and we have certainly to compete with others of these cultural endeavors in society. But I'm still positively convinced that our democratic societies in Europe have always maintained a continuous and sustained funding profile for astronomy. And astronomy is so exciting to everyone in our countries, and people are really excited and do want to know more about their origins and the origin of the universe, that I'm very optimistic that funding will continue to be able to yield these facilities that help to answer fundamental questions of mankind.
Michael Sterzig, Deputy Director of the Paranal Observatory. An Earth-like planet with Earth-like conditions, which may even support life, is tantalizing for scientific as well as cultural reasons. The ELT might well be the last major telescope funded for some decades, as the world focuses instead on getting itself out of financial trouble. But it might also be the one that detects the first signs that we're not alone in the universe. This special edition of Science Weekly was produced by Ian Chambers. I'm Alok Jha. Thanks for listening. Thank you.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.